this time to think about many things, to consider his next move in finding Helmsley and his grandmother and a cure for the poison, to reflect on the nature of trust and betrayal and how hard it was, even as a king, to find good, reliable help these days, to plot a way to regain his kingdom, or at the very least to worry about how his little cousin Jane was doing at that very moment, facing down Mary's army. But Edward didn't think about any of that. He thought about Gracie. How she was a fox. But Edward was not aware of this little irony, as to our knowledge the term fox, used to convey the attractiveness of a woman, was not invented until Jimi Hendrix sang Foxy Lady in 1967. How she was, undoubtedly, a thief. But it was all too clear to Edward that although Gracie was definitely a criminal, there was nothing common about her, and how he very much wanted to kiss her. This last part he found astounding. Gracie was the least appropriate girl in the world for him to receive his first kiss from, he knew that. He was the King of England, she was a Scottish pickpocket, but still, impractically, impossibly, he wanted to kiss her. She was the one, he'd decided, the lucky girl he was going to kiss. Now all he had to figure out was how to make said kiss happen. Usually, when Edward wanted something, he simply had to ask for it. He had no doubt that back at court, if he'd wanted a woman to kiss him, all he would have had to do is say, "Ladies such and such, I wish you to come over here right now and press your lips to mine." And his wish would have literally been her command. He wouldn't have even had to say please. But this was different. First off, as Gracie had so generously pointed out, he wasn't much of a king around here. Secondly, if he came right out and asked Gracie to kiss him, he had a feeling that she would laugh in his face. And thirdly, he didn't just want to kiss Gracie, he wanted her to want him to kiss her. But how could he make her want him to kiss her? It had seemed to Edward that she'd been at least slightly interested in the prospect of snogging back in the barn. She'd looked at him that way. He shifted uncomfortably in front of the fire. But after that, she'd immediately tried to get away from him. But then she'd been helping him. But then she was always leaving him alone. Women were complicated creatures. The bushes rustled, and Gracie the fox stuck her head out and gave a funny little bark, the cue for Edward to turn away again so that she could dress. He stared down at his feet as the Ethian light flashed, and Gracie the girl snatched up her clothes and disappeared again into the forest. When she finally emerged, she was carrying a dead rabbit and a bundle tucked under her arm. She tossed him the bundle. Edward unfolded it eagerly. Whenever she left him for a time, she always returned with something they needed, a pair of pants to start with, because that had been Edward's biggest shortcoming, followed by a battered cloak, a linen shirt, and a warm woolen blanket, a loaf of bread here, a flask of water there, a slightly rusted but otherwise decent sword, and, the pièce de résistance, boots. A fine, supple pair of boots in exactly his size. How she had pulled that off, he had no idea. He thought it best not to ask. This particular bundle turned out to be a pair of mismatched socks. "Thank you," he said, immediately kicking off his boots to put them on. "You're welcome." She didn't look at him, but sat down on a stump across from the fire and drew from her belt a hunting knife with a beautiful pearl-encrusted handle. Edward felt a bit sick as she made a cut in the rabbit's belly and then pulled its skin off in a single smooth motion. Before this, most of his food had been served to him already dressed and prepared and looking like food, not like some poor defenceless animal. He remembered the field mouse he'd eaten as a bird. His stomach grumbled unhappily. He turned his attention back to the socks. "Oh, there's a hole in the toe," he discovered.
"Is there?"
She didn't glance up from where she was now gutting the rabbit. I suppose you'd like me to mend it for you?
Yes, that'd be nice, he said, pleased, when you get time.
And you've let the fire go down, so you'll be wanting me to stoke it up again?
Whatever you need to cook the rabbit, he answered.
And should I press your shirt while I'm at it?
It is a bit wrinkled, he admitted, although he wasn't sure how she would manage it. There was a gross plop at his feet. Rabbit innards. He gasped and looked up to find her standing over him, feet apart, green eyes furious.
I'm not your serving wench!
She shook the skinned rabbit under his nose.
I said I'd help you, and I will, but I won't be ordered a boat. You're not my king, and I'm not your subject, so don't you be telling me what to do.
He blinked up at her, taken aback. I wasn't. I didn't mean to give you orders or make you do all the work. It's just that I... She folded her arms across her chest. I've never had to look after myself before, he muttered to his feet. I don't know how. She was still for a moment, and then he heard her move away. When he dared to look up again, she was roasting the rabbit on a stick over the fire, her black curls all tumbled about her face and shoulders, her expression grave as she stared into the flames. His heart sank. She hated him. She was probably thinking about what was the fastest way to be rid of him. I'm sorry, he said softly. She lifted her head and met his gaze, her face aglow with firelight.
I'm sorry, too, she said at last. I shouldn't have bitten your head off. I'm just touchy on the subject, I suppose.
The subject?
Of English kings.
Oh. He gave her a weary smile. Well, that I've noticed, but I think my head is still attached, last I checked, anyway. Her dimples appeared. She was trying not to smile back. Hope flooded back into his chest. Maybe she did like him.
I suppose it's not your fault, she said. You must be used to people waiting on your hand and foot and tripping over each other to serve you.
Yes. But he hesitated to tell her about how often he'd felt trapped in a gilded cage by all of that attention, how he'd yearned to accomplish things on his own.
And you spent your days passing royal decrees, not working to keep yourself warm and fed, she added.
He shrugged. I left most of the decree-making to my counsellors. He'd always found the running of the country to be about as interesting as watching grass grow, so he'd mostly delegated it to others. It's what they were there for, he reasoned.
So, what did you do?
She asked.
Eat, drink, and be merry all the livelong day?
No, he scoffed, but he was thinking of the way he'd started each day as king, being dressed by his servants, his morning meal taken in his private chambers on a literal silver platter, then off to his hours of lessons with the most impressive tutors of the realm, then lunch. Then he'd spent the afternoons, before his illness had struck him anyway, playing tennis or practising at archery and sword play. He was fairly good with the lute, too, and sometimes he'd perform little plays with his grooms, and sometimes he'd gone hunting for deer and bears and... gulp. Foxes. It occurred to Edward then that in some ways he'd always been preparing to be a king instead of truly being one. He cleared his throat.
So, how old were you, he asked, to change the subject, when you discovered you were an Ethian?
Oh, I've always known it, Gracie answered. She turned the rabbit slowly to its other side.
My ma and da were, and all my aunts and uncles and cousins and such. It would have been a great disappointment to me if I'd turned out differently.
But when did you know you were a fox? He asked. She shrugged.
Many Scots are foxes, and harts and hinds, martens and roes. The beasts of the chase we are. Why else do you think the English have taken such pleasure in hunting us?
Gulp.
the English, a.k.a. Edward, although he considered the bad blood between England and Scotland to be completely his father's doing, certainly not his own, except for all that business with Mary, Queen of Scots. He shuddered. "So why are you helping me, if you're Scottish and I'm English and we should be trying to kill each other?" She lifted the roasting stick from the fire and drew out her knife again to divide the rabbit. To answer his question, she said, "I've always had a weak spot for the truly pathetic creatures of this world." "Thanks," he said wryly, and promptly burned his tongue on the rabbit. "God's teeth, that's hot." Gracie handed him a flask of water, which he took gratefully. "So, tell me about this granny of yours who's going to save the day." She had the sense to blow on the meat before she began to eat it, and for a moment Edward just watched her. "Your granny at Helmsley," she prompted.
"Oh, she's the old Queen Mother," Edward explained. "My father's mother, Elizabeth. She was supposed to have died half a century ago, even before my father became king. But they only told the people she'd died when in truth they spirited her to Helmsley, where she's been ever since."
"Why?"
"Because she's a skunk."
Gracie snorted with laughter. "A skunk?"
"An Ethian, in the time when it was illegal to be an Ethian," Edward continued around a more careful mouthful of rabbit. "But my grandfather loved her. He truly loved her, so rather than burn her at the stake, he decided to stage her death and send her away. We'd take a trip out to the country to see her every few years, Mary and Bess and I, and my cousin Jane a few times too, since Gran is her great-grandmother. She's so old. She's got to be nearing 90 now, I'd say, and she has no decorum whatsoever. Once she made Father so angry that he turned into a lion, and we were afraid he'd devour her, but then she turned into a skunk and sprayed him right in the face. It took weeks for him to be rid of the smell."
"Sounds like I'm going to like her," Gracie said with a grin.
"Jane and I adored her. She loved to play games with us. It's her face on the cards, you know, whenever you draw the Queen of Hearts."
"Is that so?"
Gracie was already done with her rabbit and flung its bones into the brush. She always ate quickly, without anything resembling manners, as if she might have to flee at any moment. Edward, on the other hand, was taking time to savour his rabbit. He was finding this fire-cooked food better than anything he'd been served in the palace, because now, when he ate, he was always so hungry, and he could feel the food giving his body strength that he desperately needed. This food was giving him life.
"So, is it really only a day left before we arrive at Helmsley?" he asked when he was finished.
"If we don't run into any more problems."
Gracie sucked at a bit of rabbit grease on her fingers.
"But, like I've said time and again, we could get there much faster if you'd only..."
"And I've told you time and again," Edward interrupted, "I'm not going to become a bird and ride on your shoulder like your pet. If it were so simple as that, I could change and fly straight there, couldn't I? I could leave you behind."
"Well, don't be staying on my account."
She leaned back on her arms and gazed up at the stars.
"Fly, then."
"I can't," he admitted. "I don't know the way." She made a sound like a chuckle. "Besides," Edward continued lightly, "I suppose I've come to enjoy your company."
It could have been hopeful thinking, but the Scot seemed pleased at this announcement. "Have you now? Well, I suppose I like your company as well, when you're not being a spoiled brat."
"Oh, thank you very much," he muttered.
"You're quite welcome. But you should fly away if you can. Helmsley wouldn't be very far as the kestrel flies."
He shook his head.
"When I'm a bird, I forget myself. I forget everything but the wind and the sky. I'm just flying, floating above it all, and it's the best feeling in the world. I'm not sick, I'm not king, I'm free."
She moved closer to him when he spoke of flying, her expression pensive. She gazed up at the stars, and he tried not to be distracted by the alluring arc of her neck.
"It does look lovely up there," she murmured. "I've often dreamed of flying.
But I lose all sense of time and purpose when I do," he continued. "Does that happen to you when you change? Does the animal take over?" She looked thoughtful.
"I do have foxy thoughts sometimes. A love of holes, of running, the squawk of a chicken just before my teeth sink in."
She blushed and showed her dimples again, eyes dancing in the firelight.
"He pretended to stretch his arms in order to shift even closer to her.
This isn't in the history books, of course, but we'd like to point out that this was the first time a young man had ever tried that particular arm-stretch move on a young woman. Edward was the inventor of the arm-stretch, a tactic that teenage boys have been using for centuries." Gracie didn't move away. Kiss might have happened then, but at that exact moment the wind shifted, sending a cloud of smoke from the fire into their faces. They both coughed, of course, but Edward coughed and coughed until his vision blurred. "Cursed Dudley and his poison and his plan and all this wretched coughing," he thought. No way she'd kiss him after he'd just hacked up half his lungs. Gracie jumped to her feet and made herself busy tending to the fire. "Anyway, you're a greenie," she said as she strategically arranged more pieces of wood. "You've just discovered your Ethian form. You'll learn to control it in time." He sighed.
"How do you control it?"
"It's not so hard. When I want to change, I take a deep breath to clear the head, and I think something like, 'To be a fox now would be to find our supper. And to find our supper would be to help the young king, and then the fox rises to the occasion.' Speaking of which," she added, turning to her pack, "I've brought us some dessert."
She took out a handkerchief and unfolded it, and there, glistening in the firelight, was a handful of blackberries. Edward didn't know what happened. One minute he was fine, pleased even at the prospect of having the taste of blackberries on his tongue again, and then the next he was thrashing in a violent series of seizures, his eyes rolling back in his head, his mouth foaming. He could barely discern Gracie's face over him, her eyes wide with worry. After several moments, the shaking passed. He lay for a while, curled onto his side, exhausted and panting, then coughing again, always coughing, then vomiting up rabbit. When he was done, Gracie laid her cool hand against his forehead.
"You're hot,"
she murmured. He wished he could take that as a compliment.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I don't have one or two days to get to Helmsley, do I? I'm still dying, apparently."
Her jaw set.
"You need to change. It's the only way."
All that was left of his pride seemed to have deserted him.
"How?"
he whispered.
"I'll wrap you loose so you won't be injured, and bind you to me, and carry you."
"Bind me to you?"
he croaked, struggling to keep his eyes open.
"Like a mother would carry her bairn," she said, grabbing his hand. "You'd be safe, and we'd go quickly. I can run like the wind, even when I'm not a fox."
She pulled his hand into her chest, where he could feel the strong beat of her heart.
"I promise you, I can get you to your granny."
"All right,"
he whispered, a hint of a smile appearing on his lips.
"I can't very well say no to spending the night resting against your bosom, can I?"
She snatched his hand away.
"Don't be fresh."
He gave a soft laugh, and then he was a kestrel. Gracie sighed and pulled the cloak around him, and it was dark and warm there against her and good. Really, really good. he became slowly aware of a faintly bad smell. He stretched and was surprised to find himself in his human body again, on a real bed, it felt like, covered in furs. He opened his eyes. A single candle burned in the darkness, and as his eyes adjusted, he could make out a figure sitting by his bed, a woman.
"Gracie? Where are we?"
"You're at Helmsley," said a voice, but it wasn't the Scots voice. It was Bess. She smiled at him and caught his hand.
"I was beginning to think you wouldn't make it." "I was beginning to think so, too," he admitted.
"Here." She brought a cup to his lips. He drank and then hissed at the taste. It wasn't water, but a concoction so foul it made his eyes tear.
"It will snake the poison from your blood," Bess told him. "Gran made it."
"Gran's here?"
"Of course I'm here," came a gruff old voice from the doorway. "Where else do you suppose I would be?"
"Hello, Gran.
You've got yourself into quite a pickle, haven't you, my boy?" Gran said.
She went to the window and drew back the heavy velvet curtains. Warm midday sunshine poured in.
"Gran," Bess admonished warmly, "you shouldn't address him as boy. He's still the king."
"He's a bird-brained boy, as far as I can tell," the old lady cackled. "I mean, getting himself poisoned. My word, child, people tried to poison me 10 times a day when I was queen. None of them ever succeeded."
"Yes, Gran," he said. "It was in poor form to get myself poisoned."
"Now get up," she ordered. "You need to get the blood moving through you to give the antidote a chance to work."
He still felt light-headed and wobbly, but he didn't argue. He let Bess support him as he sat up and swung his legs out of bed. That's when he discovered he was wearing only the white linen shirt Gracie had stolen for him, which hit him mid-thigh.
"Where are my pants?"
Gran scoffed.
"Oh, please, it's nothing I haven't seen before."
She got on the other side of him and poked him in the ribs.
"Up with you!"
He stood. It did not escape his notice that Gran was as unpleasantly fragrant as ever, but the skunk smell was actually working to clear his head. He felt weak and hollowed out and half-naked, of course, but decidedly better. Maybe he wasn't going to die. Gracie appeared in the doorway. Her gaze went straight to his white, white legs.
"Your Majesty," she said with a grin and curtsied impertinently, which looked all wrong because she was still wearing trousers.
Or maybe he wanted to die, after all. Still, as Gran had said, it was nothing she hadn't seen before. Gran and Bess were both looking from Gracie to Edward and back again with amused expressions. Then Bess snapped out of it and fetched his pants. He tried to ignore his burning face as she helped him put them on, one leg and then the other. Once they were fastened, he stood up straight and said,
"I can manage,"
shook Bess off as she tried to help him, and walked slowly but steadily across the room to the window. It looked like a summer day outside. Birds singing, green grasses swaying in a half-tended garden below, sky so blue you would doubt that it had ever rained.
"How long have we been here?"
he asked.
"You arrived early this morning,"
Bess provided. Less than a day, then. Gracie had run them here in less than a day. He glanced back at her.
"You can run pretty fast for a girl."
"Well, I may have held up a nobleman on the road and borrowed his horse," she confessed.
A crime punishable by death, he remembered.
"I owe my life to you," he said.
Her dimples appeared.
"A girl does what she can, sire."
"Oh, I like her," Gran announced. "Can you play cards, my dear?"
"A bet." "And I hear you're the Queen of Hearts," Gracie answered, which clearly pleased the old lady even more.
"There's no time for cards, Gran." Bess's expression was so solemn that she vaguely resembled Mary for a moment, which made Edward remember Mary and her soldiers marching toward his castle. Gran sighed.
"True enough for you, but not so for me. Come along, you," she said to Gracie, grabbing the girl's arm and towing her toward the door. "I'll show you how to play trump."
"Keep an eye on her sleeves," Edward called after them. "You never know what she might be hiding up there."
Gracie made a face that said, "Do I look like an amateur to you?" And he was tempted to warn Gran, too, that the Scot was more than what she seemed, but then they were gone.
"We need to talk," Bess said in a low voice.
He crossed back to the window and leaned against the sill. Bess closed the door, then pulled a chair up beside him.
"All right, Bess," he murmured, suddenly tired again. "Tell me what's happened." "Jane became queen as you intended."
"As Dudley intended,"
he corrected darkly.
"The Duke also attempted to capture Mary and me and throw us in the tower so we would pose no threat to Jane's rule,"
Bess continued.
"But I slipped out when I heard them coming, and Mary caught wind of it through one of her craftier spies and escaped to her estate at Kenninghall, and from there she went to Flanders to enlist help from the Holy Roman Emperor. She raised an army, of course, and from what I understand, she took back the throne this morning."
"We need to go," Edward said. "I need to be there now."
Bess shook her head.
"Mary wanted this, for you to be dead and the crown upon her own head, to rid the kingdom of Ethians and return to the purity of the old days. She will stop at nothing."
He remembered the bite of poisoned pudding that his sister had pressed firmly to his lips to ensure that very thing.
"So she was in on it all along?" he asked, "with Dudley?"
"No."
Bessie's mouth tightened.
"It was by chance that Mary and I found out about Dudley poisoning you. One day, on our way to see you, we happened to overhear a conversation between the doctor and the nurse concerning an extra ingredient they were adding to your blackberries. When Mary confronted Dudley about it, he claimed that he was paving the way for Mary to take the throne, although I think he always intended for Jane to rule, and for Gifford to rule over Jane, and Dudley himself to rule over Gifford. But Mary bought his story and played along, as did I, although all the while I was trying to find a way to save you."
"Like with the jar of apricots," he remembered. "You did save me."
She nodded and smiled at him tenderly.
"You're my little brother. I could not stand by and let any harm come to you."
"But Mary is my sister too," Edward said. "She's my godmother, for heaven's sake. How dare she try to steal away my birthright? I am the rightful king."
He was overcome by another wave of fatigue, so much that Bess rose to offer him her chair, and he couldn't help but accept.
"I am the king," he muttered.
"Not to Mary, you're not,"
Bess said, putting her hand on his shoulder.
"Not any more."
17. Jane. There was no battle for the kingdom. Within minutes of Mary's arrival, red-coated soldiers had swarmed in, wrested Gifford's sword away from him, not that he really attempted to use it, and bound Jane and Gifford's hands with ropes. In short order, they were marched down the stairs and through the tower at sword point.
"I'll try reasoning with her," Jane said as they made their way to the throne room.
"Do you think it will do any good?"
Gifford was pale, but she could see he was trying to be brave.
"I don't know. Just let me do the talking. Everyone knows that Mary hates Ethians."
She can't tell just by looking at me, you know. It's not like I have a tail hidden in my trousers.
Even so, now would be a fantastic time to learn to control your gift.
They reached the throne room, which was packed with soldiers and nobility alike. Her ladies-in-waiting were all there, a few looking faint on account of all the excitement, while others had their noses turned up like they'd never thought Jane made a good queen anyway. Her mother was there. She looked up as Jane and Gifford entered, but didn't meet Jane's eyes. A guard poked Jane in the ribs to get her moving toward the throne, where Mary waited. Edward's eldest sister reclined in the throne, Jane's crown already gracing her brow. She wore a voluminous gown of crimson damask, with roses embroidered along the blue background of the hems. She looked regal, as though she'd known her whole life that this was what she was meant to do.
"Jane." Mary's tone was sweet as she leaned forward. "You haven't been harmed?"
Jane stood before her own throne. She kept herself as straight and tall as possible and let her eyes sweep over the assembly near the throne, dukes, members of the Privy Council, and standing at the front, John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland.
"You," Jane murmured, "whose side are you on now?"
His only answer was a slippery smile.
"Jane,"
a note of irritation snapped in Mary's voice,
"you haven't been harmed?"
Jane turned her eyes back on Mary.
"You're sitting in my chair."
A few people in the crowd gasped, but Mary only smiled.
"Jane, dear one, surely you know that it was only through the plots of others that you managed to sit here at all. The throne was always meant to be mine, until Edward,"
her voice cracked at the late king's name,
"produced an heir. Unfortunately, my brother never had that opportunity. He was taken from us too quickly. The law states that I am next in the line of succession."
"Edward amended his will. It was his final act before he died."
Jane didn't look at Lord Dudley again, but hadn't that been exactly what he'd said? Now he was just standing there, accepting Mary as queen.
"I feel sorry for you, Jane."
Mary nodded to herself.
"You were caught in this game without the smallest hint how to play it."
"Edward left the throne to me."
Jane kept her voice soft but firm.
"He revised the line of succession."
"My brother was ill and persuaded to do nonsensical things by certain parties who had everything to gain."
Mary looked pointedly at Lord Dudley.
"Those parties were given a choice, the same choice I'm going to give to you."
"But the crown is not your right,"
Jane said, in spite of feeling, just days before, that it wasn't her right either.
Jane at least knew it, while Mary seemed to feel entitled to the throne.
"The Privy Council disagrees."
The Privy Council had voted to give the crown to Mary? Jane prickled. How dare they turn on her? She could not believe it. After listening to them brag about themselves for hours on her first day as queen, she rather felt she'd earned their respect and loyalty.
"As I said,"
Mary went on,
"I want to be fair. I'm giving everyone a choice to bow to me."
Gifford, who had been quiet all this time, suddenly leaned toward Jane until his mouth was against her ear.
"I have to get out of here,"
he said urgently.
"It's almost morning."
He was right.
She could sense the glow of dawn behind the windows, and Mary was not turning out to be very reasonable.
"Give us until tonight," Jane pleaded. "We need time to consider..."
"There's nothing to consider," Mary said. "It's a simple yes or no." Gifford shifted from foot to foot.
"Jane..." "I haven't slept or eaten," Jane argued. "Before I make such a decision, I need to rest, to think. Please, if we could just..."
It was too late. The first ray of sunshine breached the window. Next to Jane, another kind of light flared. There was the sound of clothing tearing and hooves clapping against the marble floor. The crowd let out a collective gasp of horror. Guards rushed forward, swords in hand. Mary surged up from the throne. Jane's heart sank. Gifford was a horse. Jane had the wild thought of leaping onto Gifford's back and riding away as quickly as they could. Of course, that would violate horse rule number 3, no riding the horse. But it would be difficult for him to navigate the narrow, winding stairs in his current state, and even though Gifford was pressing close to Jane as if to protect her, there was no way to climb atop him. Her hands were still bound behind her back.
"Seize them!" Mary commanded. Soldiers yanked her away. She tried to wriggle free, and Gifford snapped and kicked, but then one of the men held a sword to Gifford's long neck. Someone else pressed a knife to Jane's throat.
Girl and horse met each other's eyes, and that was when they stopped fighting.
"Well..."
Mary settled back onto the throne. She spoke with that sweet voice again, but now Jane couldn't miss the edge of contempt.
"How surprising."
One of the guards looped a rope around Gifford's neck. He didn't resist. A guard came up behind Jane, cut the ropes binding her wrists, and clasped on a pair of metal shackles, which seemed like overkill.
"Dearest Jane," Mary said, "my late brother had such fondness for you. It is in his memory that I make this offer. That, and as I said earlier, I have always felt a little sorry for you. Not just because you couldn't comprehend the game being played around you, but because of that unfortunate red hair of yours. It's just... well, I don't want to be rude."
"No," Jane thought, "you just want to take my throne and kill my husband." She turned to look at Gifford, who didn't stir. He'd only been her husband for a little while. Such a very little amount of time, relatively speaking. She didn't know his favourite colour, or the food he liked best, outside of apples, which seemed like a horse preference. She'd assumed he'd been part of this game, trying to manipulate her like everyone else, but that didn't matter to her now. What would happen to him? What would happen to them both?
"My offer is fair, and I urge you to accept," Mary was saying.
"I'm still waiting to hear what it is," Jane said numbly.
"Ah, dear, I'm sorry. I thought it must have been obvious what I want from you. What everyone else has already done."
Mary gestured at Lady Frances and Lord Dudley.
"Accept me as your rightful queen and denounce evil. Denounce heretics. Denounce Ethians."
"Of course."
"Sweet little Jane, you like to prattle on about Ethians and heroes and other such nonsense. You are young, and those sorts of things seem attractive to you. But you must grow up now. Renounce the Ethians, including your husband, and live out the rest of your days in exile. I have arranged for you to be sent to a monastery, even. You'll be quite safe and comfortable there."
"And if I don't agree?" Mary made a swift slice of her hand over her throat.
I didn't think that needed to be said either, what with the extensive reading you've done, but I suppose I've overestimated you.
Jane glanced at her mother, who nodded, urging her to give in, as she herself must have done. The throne room was silent as everyone waited to hear Jane's answer.
"What will happen to my husband?" she asked.
Mary shook her head with false sadness, but her eyes were sparkling.
"In the morning he will be burned at the stake."
Jane's hands flew to her mouth,
or rather would have, but she was still shackled.
The metal bit deeply into her wrists as she strained against it. "No," she breathed. "Don't hurt him. He can't help what he is."
Mary tilted her head.
"So, you knew that he is an abomination?"
Jane's eyes cut to Dudley.
The Duke said,
"Of course I hadn't the faintest idea, Your Majesty. If Gifford was in and out of the house at all hours and refused to go to court, I assumed my son was merely acting out like any normal boy. Why would I assume he had something darker to hide?"
"That's a lie," Jane said, but no one cared.
"This is about you, dear. Did you know your husband was a beast?"
Mary pressed. "I found out on our wedding night. Everyone who knew," she glared at Dudley, "neglected to tell me."
"And were you surprised?"
Mary's tone was honey-sweet.
"Certainly."
"And do you reject his vile magic? Do you renounce your ties to him?"
Mary leaned forward.
"It's simple. Name yourself a verity, and your life will be spared. Or deny me, and I'll have your head."
Jane closed her eyes. Her shoulders ached. Her wrists stung, and liquid heat dripped down her hands. Blood. Never before had she been so mistreated, and a desperate part of her wanted to say, yes, she denounced him, and she'd go live in a monastery, exiled for the rest of her days. But Gifford would die. He hadn't abandoned her. A former womanizer and drunk and current horse, he might be, but he'd just proven himself to be the most loyal person in her life. In spite of the way she'd treated him, her accusations and her hurled pillows and her scorn, he'd tried to warn her. He hadn't fled when the army arrived. He hadn't switched sides. Could she abandon him now? Gifford the horse had kept his head down throughout this entire interrogation, his nose almost brushing the floor, the very picture of docility. But now he lifted his head. His eyes, at once both human and hoarse, met hers.
"Do it," his eyes urged. "Renounce me. Save yourself."
Memories of their time in the country floated back to her. Their banter, reading beneath the tree, helping those in need, and most of all, that almost kiss as the sky was deep with twilight and candles burned around them. There was no denying the truth. Gifford Dudley was a good man, Ethian or not, and he was her husband, for better or worse. The answer must have shown on her face.
"Little Jane, be reasonable."
Mary pressed her hands together.
"What purpose will your death serve?"
"It will serve to prove that you do not control this kingdom. It will serve to prove that not everyone will bow down to you. You think to rule us with fear, but you cannot. I will never renounce my beliefs or my husband."
Mary's face darkened with anger.
"Take her away and do something about this animal!" "Soldiers grabbed at Jane. She couldn't resist, not with her bleeding wrists cuffed behind her back, but she continued speaking.
Ethians are people, too. You only hate them because you fear them. Mary's guards dragged her away, and no one lifted a finger to help her.
Jane had read about despair, the hopelessness of Socrates, who'd felt no recourse but to poison himself rather than facing a life in a cave prison, the terror of Anne Boleyn, Bessie's mother, who'd been beheaded just years before after being tried for adultery, the resignation of Cleopatra, who'd taken her own life with the bite of an asp after she and her husband lost the Battle of Actium. The despair in books was a distant, safe thing. She'd thought she understood the depth of the emotion as she read through the pages of her beloved books, her life touching those of men and women long dead. She'd felt for them, cried for them, tried to breathe for them when they no longer breathed, and then she'd been able to close the book and place it on its shelf, the words trapped between the leather covers. Oh, sometimes it had taken her hours or days to recover from a particularly emotional book, but there'd always been another to take her mind off the anguish. There were no books here. Nothing could distract her from the forced march up the stairs of the Queen's house, built at the bidding of Anne Boleyn, and then, ironically, the place of her captivity before she was executed, into a bare room where Jane was to live out the remaining hours of her life. Nothing could distract her from the four brick walls surrounding her, the cold and the darkness, or the searing pain in her wrists and shoulders, even after the shackles had been removed. Too sore and tired to pace, Jane slumped in the middle of the floor. There was no furniture. It had been removed, so she couldn't spend her last night in a bed. Such decency, she inferred, was above her, an Ethian-loving heretic.
"I am 16 years old," she told the empty room, "and tomorrow I will die."
That's what the guards had told her. Tomorrow she'd be beheaded. Who would go first, her or Gifford? Would they be able to see each other? Perhaps Jane would be made to watch as her husband burned alive, and then her head would come off before she could even shed a tear. Or the other way around, maybe. Gifford might see the axe swing and a flash of red hair flying, and then they'd light the pyre beneath him. Jane hugged her knees and shuddered. Her imagination was too vivid. Night fell. She knew only because the faint light from the windows faded, not because her body gave her any useful signals. Her head was light with thirst and hunger. When she ran her tongue along her lips, they were dry and cracked. Her stomach felt hollow. If she could have escaped into sleep, she would have, but shocks of terror and dread jabbed at her mind every other minute, reminding her that these hours were the last she had left. If she slept, she'd waste them. For another hour, or some amount of time, she had no way to judge, she thought about Gifford and what he must be doing now. Likely he wasn't still in the stables, but moved somewhere more secure now that it was night. She thought about his laugh and his jokes, the charming way he found humour in everything. Would he find humour in this situation tomorrow morning?
If only she could see him now. She'd apologize for the last week and a half. She'd name him king. She'd kiss him and say she trusted him. Maybe Gifford wasn't safe to think about right now. Jane shifted her thoughts to Edward, wondering if he'd felt this deep unease in the face of his own death. Anxiety, trepidation, horror.
She tried to conjure up more synonyms, but a dim orange light flickered beneath the door. Footfalls echoed on the steps, and a moment later the door creaked open. Firelight shone in, blinding her. She squeaked and buried her face in the hollow of her arms and knees. Then, squinting, she looked up.
"Jane?"
Lady Frances rushed in, holding a torch, which she quickly set into a holder on the wall. "The guards let me in. We have a few minutes at best. I came to ask you to reconsider Mary's offer." She knelt in front of Jane, her expression almost maternal in its concern. "I wanted you to know I'm sorry I wasn't more supportive back there. Please forgive me." Jane stared at her mother. She'd never heard an apology from Lady Frances's lips before, and she wasn't sure what to do with it. "It doesn't matter," she said at last. "The throne changed hands very quickly, didn't it?" "No one resisted." Lady Frances bowed her head. "The Privy Council turned on you. Dudley betrayed us as well. The moment Mary arrived, he declared his allegiance to her, even though it means he's not the Lord President any more, and his loathing of Ethians. He declared himself a verity. He made it sound like all along he was actually clearing a path for Mary to take power. But forget about Dudley for now. This is about you. Take Mary's offer. It's not too late. A life in exile is better than this."
"No."
"Jane, this is no time to display your stubbornness."
"It's not stubbornness. It's a matter of honour. I will not denounce Gifford or Ethians. You included, Mother."
Jane coughed at the dryness in her throat. Lady Frances's eyes flickered toward the door, like she was afraid someone would overhear.
"Ungrateful girl, you have no idea what you're talking about. I'm no Ethian."
"I know you are. I heard you and Father discussing it years ago." Her mother shook her head like she might deny it, but then she sighed.
"And I hate it," she whispered. "I never change, not if I can help it. I push that part of me down until it's buried. It's unnatural."
"And yet it's part of you," Jane implored her. "In one of my books about Ethians, the author said that long ago, in ancient times, all people were able to change into an animal form. Everyone was Ethian. It was considered their true nature. It was considered divine."
"Nonsense." Her mother's expression grew cold. "All those books fill your head with such drivel. I should have burned them all, and then maybe we wouldn't be in this mess."
Jane closed her eyes for a moment. Then she pushed her stiff muscles until she was able to stand up.
"Do not ask me to forsake Ethians again, Mother. You will not change my mind."
There were voices in the hall. Lady Frances glanced over her shoulder toward the door.
"Our time is almost up," Jane said. "I suppose we should say goodbye now."
"Please, Jane," her mother grabbed her arm. "You don't have to die. It will bring ruin on the family, on me. I'll lose Bradgate. I'll lose everything."
"I'm sorry. I can't help that," Jane replied, and she meant it. She too loved Bradgate, but it wasn't worth her honour. "Do you know where Gifford is being held?"
"They took him to Beecham Tower after nightfall. That's all I know. I want to see him. Can you ask for me?" Lady Grey shook her head. "The only way to see him will be to denounce him, and then you would only see him burn." The guards arrived. They escorted Lady Frances from the room without another word between them, and Jane was alone again. Her prison seemed to shrink around her. The despair she'd known earlier became a drop in an ocean, one star to the entire universe. Her mother had abandoned her, no matter what she claimed. There was only one person left in the world to think about, and that was Gifford, locked away in Beecham Tower, so close to the Queen's house, but it might as well have been the other side of the world. Jane sank to the floor again, drowning in grief and misery and wretchedness and despondency, and a brilliant white light flared about her, making her blink back stars. When she could see again, everything was different. The room was bigger, for one, and she felt funny. Shorter,
which was saying something, but oddly long. Her spine felt strange and hunchy, and she was on all fours. And her sense of smell. There was something sour, unbathed human probably, and musky. The sound of voices below, the feel of the stone floor under her paws. It was incredible. She'd changed into something. She was an Ethian. She was an Ethian! Jane hopped around the room in a crazy little dance, thrashing her head from side to side so hard she bashed into a wall. Unfazed, she made a soft clucky sound and danced again, an overpowering sense of joy filling her. She was an Ethian, just as she'd always hoped. What was she? It didn't matter. She was small and furry. She could easily twist herself around to see her body, but it was hard to get an idea of a whole based on just a few too close views. And she had the best sense of smell and the best sense of hearing and the best dancing skills she'd ever possessed in her life, even if dancing sometimes meant she ran into walls. Wouldn't Gifford be so amused when he saw her? Gifford... The sense of elation faded as she remembered her predicament, and now that she was a something, she would likely be burned at the stake as well. But her animal self was small, she knew that, and maybe she could do something useful now. She hopped over to the door. There was a large crack beneath it, not quite big enough for a human fist to fit underneath, but maybe she could fit? Jane shoved her face into the crack beneath the door. Her head went right under, followed by her shoulders, but the rest of her body stuck a little. That was embarrassing. She squeezed and scrambled and pushed until she popped out of the other side. There was more light in the corridor, twilight to her human self, but she could see quite easily now, at least within a few feet. Everything beyond that seemed fuzzy and oddly flat. Everything was shades of grey, too, except a faint red cast to some things, like the light of a lantern on the wall. So her vision wasn't that great, but she was small and close to the floor, so what did she need with fantastic distance vision anyway? She had other senses, better senses. Jane scurried to the edge of the first stair and paused, looking down. What was nothing particularly difficult in her human form suddenly appeared quite challenging. She couldn't just step down. She pressed her belly to the stone floor and pushed her front paws ahead of her, sliding down the first stair until her paws touched the next. The rest of her body followed with an awkward flop. She repeated this process a few more times until she found a better way to control her rogue hindquarters and moved down the stairs at a quicker pace. At the first landing, she found the guards. She was the size of their boots. She resisted the urge to smell all their interesting earthy aromas and instead streaked past them so quickly they didn't notice her. Other voices below grew louder as she descended the stairs, too distant for the guards on the landing to hear, but her ears were fantastic, amazing, probably very cute. One of the speakers was Dudley. She was sure of it, though in this form the sound was overwhelming and held qualities she'd never heard as a human. "What is it?" he asked. "I've obtained a body," another man said. His voice was familiar too. The royal physician? She couldn't remember his name.
"Very good."
Dudley sneezed and sniffed.
"Drape a shroud over it, and no one will know it isn't Edward."
Jane stopped moving. It felt like all the fur on her body was standing up. They didn't have Edward's body.
"They haven't found him yet,"
asked the doctor.
"The poison would have killed him by now. There's no way he could survive without an antidote."
Dudley sighed.
"He was sick, wounded, starved.
He had to have left some kind of trail.
Their voices were fading now, as though they'd been walking by the stairs. Jane slinked down the rest of the steps, her tiny heart racing. Edward had been poisoned? Dudley had poisoned Edward, and then Edward had...